This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with our own Michael Ratner, who speaks to us from the Supreme Courthouse in Washington, D.C.
Michael was there in the courtroom and gives us a firsthand account of the battle for habeas corpus.
We'll talk with Dr. Catherine Wilkerson about her recent victory involving a police brutality case in Michigan.
Well, the cops beat her up because she's an anti-Zionist activist, and they only went after her after she criticized them. She came to the defense of a guy who they were poisoning with ammonia tablets because she's a doctor trying to help him. When she criticized him, they brought two felony charges against her. But for the Lawyers Guild, she probably would have lost.
We'll talk with historian and author Adam Hochschild on his recent book, Bury the Chains.
The exciting, amazing, and remarkable story of how the slave trade and ultimately slavery was ended in the British Empire.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights directly challenged the Bush administration's use of torture in violation of domestic and international law. This case may determine once and for all whether there is a constitutional right to habeas corpus, that is, a fair hearing before a real court, for anyone deemed by the United States government to be an enemy combatant. The case also challenges the 2006 Republican Congress's attempt to clear the way with its passage of the Military Commissions Act. This legal case may determine once and for all whether there is a constitutional right to habeas corpus, that is, a fair hearing before a real court, for everyone detained by the U.S. government at Guantanamo. We go now to co-host and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, who speaks to us in Washington, D.C.
Michael Ratner, you're down in Washington, D.C. Center for Constitutional Rights has been there three times now. Just heard the arguments trying to save habeas corpus. What's at stake and how did it go?
Well, as you said, Michael, we've been here, this is our third time, and the fundamental issue is still whether detainees or people we represent, some 350 left at Guantanamo, have a right to go into a court and say, give us a fair hearing in front of a neutral tribunal where we know the charges and can see the evidence. So it's only been 6 years for some of our clients, think about that, and they've never had that right, although twice the Supreme Court has said they do. Congress has stripped it twice, and now they finally are down to the bare-bones constitutional issue of can you strip habeas from non-citizens held at Guantanamo? In other words, can you hold people for 6 years without going to court and letting them have a trial? Well, it was a difficult argument, complicated argument. We always thought we had four justices on our side for sure, four on the other side, and Kennedy is the swing vote. We still don't know how it's going to come out. The argument opened with the Chief Justice Roberts. Those words have trouble crossing my mouth, but Chief Justice Roberts, all over the attorney arguing for us and the Guantanamo detainees, basically saying, what kind of rights do you think you have? And then Scalia coming in, going back to 250 years ago and saying, since when does the habeas corpus provision of the Constitution protect non-citizens outside the United States? Then Roberts going back and saying, we didn't even give Guantanamo, the Guantanamo detainee who was a U.S. citizen, very much rights. Why should we give these people rights? So they were very hostile. But then, of course, the government's attorney got up. The liberals on the bench really went after him, or the moderates, And Justice Breyer was really exceptional. He said, look, he didn't really say in my view, but he said, in the current situation, could a detainee say, either you have to charge me or release me, and that's it. You don't have a choice about holding me. You have to charge or release me, and if I'm not charged, you can release me, and there's no preventive detention statute here. And the Solicitor General was forced to say he couldn't even raise that claim under the current procedure, that there's no constitutional authority to hold him. And, of course, Breyer was pretty amazed by that. But I don't think Breyer has a majority on that position. I think the main thing is that they were concerned by was the adequacy of the review procedure that's been set up by Congress in its great wisdom in the Military Commission Act. And on that, they were very skeptical that detainees were going to be given any kind of rights that they should have to protect themselves. At least I think a majority were. So we're very hopeful. I think the two outcomes here, both favorable are the clients, but are the people at Guantanamo, but one less favorable. The best would be obviously to say habeas corpus applies here. What has been set up by Congress in the Military Commission Act is not an adequate substitute for habeas. You know, you're allowed to do that. And therefore, you have a right to go into federal court, which would be a great victory. The lesser victory, and I say lesser, quite a bit lesser in a way, is sending it back to the lower courts, but saying there are constitutional rights here, and whatever standards have to be measured against those rights. Now, that's a big victory, except that what it means is years more of litigation in the courts. If we look at this from a broader perspective, what do we have here? We have another year and something for the Bush administration. We won't get a decision out of this court for 3, 4, 5 months at least. We're getting close to the time when there's going to be a new administration. Whatever that administration is, if it's likely to be Democrat, will then be handed the problem of Guantanamo. Now, I have no great confidence that they're going to do a lot to cure that problem, but they also aren't the Bush administration. So my hope is that they put an end to this litigation by saying people finally have fundamental rights.
Michael, just for those of us who haven't seen the Supreme Court and this particular court in action, I assume Justice Thomas didn't say anything.
Justice Thomas was utterly quiet.
And what about Justice Ginsburg?
Justice Ginsburg, asked a number of intelligent questions and made some comments. She was not the most active. The most active, really, of the moderates to liberals would be Justice Breyer and Justice Souter, who were pretty solidly, I think, in the camp of rights for the people at Guantanamo and habeas. Ginsburg there as well. Kennedy, being the key swing vote, also asked a fair number of questions, but harder to tell, although I think he certainly thinks that the review the government has given people is inadequate. Well, the argument ended with Seth Waxman, the lawyer arguing for the Center for Constitutional Rights and the other clients, basically giving two examples of what could have or should have happened in these cases. One was an example in which a client was said, you're accused by the military procedures at Guantanamo, you're accused of hanging out or being associated with an Al-Qaeda person. And the man says, well, can you tell me his name? And they said, we can't tell you the name. It's classified. And then the guy says, well, how do I know how to refute that if I don't even know the name? I know I've never hung out with anybody who's Al-Qaeda, but if I don't even know this guy's name, what can I say? And they wouldn't give him the name. So that's an example of the current situation. And they also gave another example, Murat Kurnaz, who's currently in Germany right now, but had been 5 years in Guantanamo. And they had accused him of being involved with the terrorist who then blew himself up in a suicide bombing. And of course, once he got an attorney and was able to go to the German authorities and others, he demonstrated that the guy he supposedly associated with and was involved in a suicide bombing was living well and going on with his life in a city in Germany, had no relationship with terrorism at all. So we have a fraud here. We have a complete scandal. We have 350 people left at Guantanamo.
Going even beyond the unfortunate people in the main in Guantanamo who were ripped off from other countries, sold by bounty hunters and stuck there now for 5 years, but going beyond these non-American citizens, how would this case, with respect to what they decide on whether non-citizens have a right to habeas corpus, how does this relate to citizens' right to habeas corpus, and how does habeas corpus relate to the whole struggle for progressive social change in America?
Well, certainly, in the initial phase of the so-called war on terror, the Bush position was that even citizens didn't have a right to habeas corpus if the president decided they were so-called enemy combatants. And that, of course, is the Jose Padilla case as well as the Hamdi case. Listeners may be familiar, Jose Padilla is sadly known as the dirty bomber case, although he was never accused of that, who got off a plane in Chicago, held without habeas for a number of years. Hamdi was allegedly picked up on a battlefield, U.S. citizen, again held in the U.S. without habeas for a number of years. So they attempted to apply that ruling to both those people. The Supreme Court has actually never ruled on those cases. They did rule on Hamdi, giving him some rights, but they didn't rule directly. By that time, the government already conceded he could have an attorney. But that question is still probably open, although I think the majority of the court, and not just the five that we may get on this case, but even people like Scalia believe that you can't deny a citizen in the United States habeas. That doesn't mean that a citizen picked up overseas or one like Hamdi in Afghanistan, if not taken to the United States but taken to Guantanamo, couldn't be denied habeas. So it's still in some, I would say there's slight doubts, but hopefully not too many. But obviously, the Bush administration, in believing there's a so-called war on terror and the world being a battlefield, believes that they can pick up people in the so-called war on terror on the battlefield, including the United States, and hold them without the right of habeas corpus and the right to go to court. And clearly it implicates what happens in the future, because to the extent we have revolt, we have dissent in this country, we have unrest in this country, that the administration decides to label as terrorism, insurrection, or anything else, they're going to use these powers in this country against citizen and non-citizen. And that seems to be 100% clear to me.
Michael, speaking of dissent, were there protesters outside the courthouse?
Yes, it was quite wonderful because it was quite cold. It was snowing, wet, yet there was my favorite group, Witness Against Torture, coming out of really a Catholic worker and others who have been wearing orange jumpsuits demonstrating against Guantanamo. They have a closed-down Guantanamo campaign. They've been all over the country, back the world. They're the ones who stood outside of Senator Schumer's office protesting his confirmation vote for the waterboarding Judge Mukasey. They were there outside. They have a great new poster that actually has done in the ink that you see prisoners of war posters done in, or those flags. It says POW, and then it has a picture of Guantanamo, prisoner of war Guantanamo. So it was quite photographed, and quite a lot of attention was paid to their demonstration.
Michael, it's going to be months before a decision comes down. How do you think it's going to turn out?
Well, I think we're going to win. I just don't know. And the terms will win, and those terms will make a big difference, because they will mean whether our clients, whether the people we represent at Guantanamo get immediate hearings and can get out of there, or whether we're going to be dragged through the courts for another year or two, which would be a disaster. And that's what I think Justice Breyer was saying. 6 years, no hearing, no charges, and there's no preventive detention statute in the United States. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Okay, guys, bye-bye.
Earlier this year, Law and Disorder covered the case of Dr. Catherine Wilkerson, in which police used excessive force in attacking peaceful protesters rallying at the University of Michigan at an event sponsored by the American Movement for Israel. As a senior medical professional on the scene, Dr. Wilkerson took responsibility for the well-being of a middle-aged man who claimed he couldn't breathe and then lost consciousness. She implored the police to get off of him and was allowed to check his pulse and breathing. Wilkerson later protested when emergency medical service personnel breached ethical medical practices by forcing ammonia into the man's nostrils. It was at this time that she was physically assaulted and detained by Ann Arbor police. No charges were filed until after Dr. Wilkerson wrote a complaint to authorities about the actions of the police. A week after writing the letter, she was charged by the Washtenaw County prosecutor, Brian Mackey's office, at the request of the University of Michigan police, with two attempted felonies, one against Officer Warner and one against EMS personnel. Last week, Dr. Wilkerson was acquitted by a jury of all of the charges against her. We're pleased to have her join us today.
Catherine, you had a splendid victory out there in Ann Arbor. You were at a demonstration against the American Movement for Israel. Is that what it's called? You helped somebody out, and for your trouble, they charged you with two attempted felonies. Last week, you and your attorney, Buck Davis, broke free. Tell us, how was this accomplished and what was at stake here?
Well, having a criminal conviction with potentially jail time, I don't know what it would have meant for my professional status and my career, but I suspect it would have been devastating. My reputation would have been destroyed. As for the movement, I think there were a number of issues that were very important. The right of any individual to criticize people in positions of authority, particularly the police, when witnessing something egregious that those officials are doing. And this was a huge issue to us. This is protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. There's nothing illegal about yelling at or criticizing police officers, or in my case, there was also the issue of a paramedic.
And you as a professional were yelling and criticizing them because what they were doing to this poor guy was down on the ground, right?
Yes. The other issue is from the outset that it was a question of repression of dissent and free expression. The actions of the university police that night were in violation of their own free speech policies at the university.
Did they try to break up the protesters outside the meeting?
The police dragged a protester down onto the floor out of a chair, and another person went to her aid, and they dragged him off. And then as they were arresting her, her husband became very upset, and I didn't see this part. They accused him of having inserted his body in between the police and his wife. In response to that, instead of trying to de-escalate the situation, according to two eyewitnesses, one of the University of Police reached out with his arm and threw the man head first, face first, I should say, onto a marble floor.
Is there some kind of history of pig practices on the part of the campus police there, or is this something unusual, or does it relate to the whole situation with the Zionist activists on campus? I mean, how do you explain this?
I think that there are several aspects to it. There are other examples lately of excessive force by DPS that have been brought to my attention, and I think that they are becoming more and more thuggish as time goes by. I think that's consistent with some of the other repressive actions of law enforcement in other places as well. It's not isolated to there, but that's one aspect of it. I think that it was at the behest of the organizers who, as you mentioned before, were from a student organization on campus called the American Movement for Israel, which was hosting Ray Tanner, who is co-founder of the Iran Policy Committee, which endorses intervention for regime change against Iran. So they were, the AMI kids brought Tanner in, and we went to protest because he has called for regime change, and not only through peaceful means, but he believes that one option would be for Israel to engage in a preemptive first strike using robust nuclear earth penetrators against Iran. So it was a very disturbing event that night. It was political. It was not academic. It was political to its core. And so I think that when the AMI kids called the cops in to start arresting people and dragging them out, definitely brought in the issue of Israel and Zionism as well into the event, which, of course, it was laced with from the beginning. But as far as, I think your question was, is this about that? I think it was partly about the influence of the Zionist organizations on campus and in the community here and elsewhere. And I think it also is about the general climate in this country, which is repressive with regard to dissent. And I think it's part of the reason that there is such a feeble, if any, anti-war movement on the campus of the University of Michigan at the present time. I think it's one of the factors.
Now, let's talk about what happened in court. You were represented by a longtime Guild member, Hugh Buck Davis. the prosecution's attorney was Margaret Connors. What was the thrust of Buck's argument on your behalf?
I should add that he had a co-counsel, Wilson Tanner. They were a wonderful team together. Buck was the lead counsel, and his argument was, first of all, that the police and the paramedic, they didn't have the authority under our Constitution to throw me out of the area and remove me from the area because I was criticizing what they were doing. That was one of the issues. The free speech issues, the First Amendment issues were core to his discussions, that anyone, doctor or not, has the right to voice and vocally voice criticism in these situations. Also, there was a medical necessity defense, and that is that what set them off against me was when I pointed out to a paramedic that what he was doing was wrong and told him to stop because it was inefficacious and it was punitive. That caused the police to go into motion against me.
Didn't Margaret Connors on that point say that Dean Lloyd's use of ammonia was because he thought the patient was faking?
Yes. This is it's been done a lot where particularly EMS personnel, but sometimes nurses and even doctors use ammonia in punitive ways. There's absolutely not one shred of evidence in the medical literature that ammonia has any legitimate medical use, particularly when someone has head trauma and is unconscious and could have cervical spine injury. It's really bad medical care.
Right. And that admission, though, in fact, was damaging to the prosecution's case, but Connors apparently never acknowledged or understood that.
Apparently she didn't, because she argued vociferously in her closing arguments. Still, despite the fact that we had evidence, the person whose aid I went to, Mr. Coleman, had a cerebral contusion, which is a type of traumatic brain injury, he was acknowledged by all medical professionals involved, with the exception of Dean Lloyd, even by the paramedic who wrote up the report for them, to have had an altered level of consciousness, including a period of unconsciousness. Despite that, she continued without any reservation, apparently, to claim that it was still their position that he was faking.
So the jury deliberated for over 4 hours. Were you surprised with their verdict of not guilty, two verdicts of not guilty?
I had believed from the very beginning that if I had the opportunity to present my defense and if I had a jury that was fair, that there was no way that I could be convicted of these crimes. However, when I heard the second not guilty verdict read, I was thrilled beyond description, because you never know.
Right. It must have been a great relief. You never know, especially during these political times. I wanted to ask, what kind of public support did you get in your case?
I received such an outpouring of public support that without that solidarity, I don't know if I would have had the moral fortitude to make it through to the end. It was awful. It was a horrible time to go through. But getting the messages that I would get from people from literally all over the world, which started really after I published my piece on Counterpunch, I have to give Alex Coburn many, many thanks. He's been really helping me to get the word out. And then I had some folks from the Answer Coalition that got thousands of signatures on a petition for me. So I've had a great deal of support. And in the local community, I had a great group of people on a defense committee who worked so hard for me, and some of my patients, people in the community. It shows that with solidarity, a person has at least a fighting chance. And that's what the bottom line to me in all of this, and that's what came out of it.
Well, I know that many Guild members reading about this victory have been absolutely thrilled. Sends an important message, as you say, that sort of a solidarity movement coupled with litigation, we can really have a good chance at fighting this repressive regime.
Dr. Catherine Wilkerson, from Ann Arbor. We're very proud of you, proud of the struggle of you and your comrades. And thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Today we welcome back author, journalist, and activist Adam Hochschild. He's going to talk to us about his new book, Bury the Chains. The book takes the reader back to the late 18th century when a small group of Englishmen put forward the radical notion that slavery and the slave trade was wrong. They proposed that the Enlightenment ideals of equality and liberty should extend to African slaves held in British colonies. Hochschild writes, "Though born in the age of swords, wigs, and stagecoaches, the British anti-slavery movement leaves us an extraordinary legacy. A legacy of tools, says Hochschild, that activists use today. They include consumer boycotts, newsletters, petitions, political posters, and national committees. Whenever you get down about the current situation we're in today, think back on how the slave trade was ended."
Welcome, Adam, to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Adam, you wrote just the most marvelous book, Bury the Chains, about the movement that ended slavery in England. And it's got so many lessons, it's really hard to find out where to start. But I wanted to ask you about the key figures in the movement and then the lessons that we learned from how they organized it. Let's first talk about somebody that's not generally appreciated, and that's the person who you really bring to life, Thomas Clarkson. Can you tell us about him?
Well, here's his story, and I hope that through it your listeners can see what fun it was to write about this really quite extraordinary movement. Thomas Clarkson was a divinity student at Cambridge University in the 1780s, and as he was about to graduate, he entered a contest for the best Latin essay, and winning one of these Latin prizes at Oxford or Cambridge was a huge deal at the time. It was like winning the Heisman Trophy in college football or something. People remembered it for the rest of your life. And as it happened, the topic for the annual Cambridge Latin Essay Contest that year was, is it right to make people slaves against their will? The university had a rather eccentric head who was one of the very few people in England who questioned the idea of slavery, and he thought he could bring some more attention to the issue by making it the topic of the annual Cambridge Latin Essay Contest. Clarkson had no previous interest in slavery or the slave trade. He just wanted to win that Latin prize. He entered the contest. He won. And in the course of researching to write his Latin essay, he was just bowled over with horror at everything he learned about slavery. He read everything he could find on the subject, and what impressed me as a journalist is that he was sort of a natural investigative reporter. He went out and interviewed people who'd worked in the West Indies, who'd seen slavery firsthand. He discovered that a friend of his family's had owned slave ships, and the man had recently died. Clarkson got access to his papers, went through them, wrote his essay, won the prize, read his essay aloud in Latin, and then graduated and got on his horse to set off for London to make his way in the world.
I love that part of the book.
you have the number in there, but thousands of miles on that horse interviewing, what, captains and others around slave trade, right?
Over the next 7 or 8 years, he estimated he would cover 35,000 miles by horseback around Britain organizing for this movement.
Staying at people's houses, I mean, in rain and sleet. I mean, the story that you bring to life there about him.
Well, he was an extraordinary guy, and I think what's also interesting is that as a young man, he was very much a political radical in other ways as well. He was a tremendous enthusiast for the French Revolution. When 4 years after winning this Latin Prize at Cambridge and dedicating his life to ending slavery, the Bastille fell in Paris. He rushed to Paris, took a stone from the ruins of the Bastille, brought it home with him 6 months later, and it stayed in his living room the rest of his life. He was somebody who had a wonderful, flaming sense of justice on all issues: women's rights, widening the franchise, the rights of labor, all these kinds of things, but slavery was always foremost for him.
Adam, tell us about John Newton and Clarkson's encounter with John Newton. That's kind of a hidden history.
Sort of Adam's encounter also.
Yeah.
And in some way, Adam, it's my own encounter, because for years I grew up playing my children Amazing Grace and telling them about this slave ship captain who had a conversion and, you know, hearing Paul Robeson sing the song. And then I read your book, and I'm you can tell the story.
Well, the way most people hear John Newton's story is, here is this man who was in the most dreadful of all trades. He was a slave ship captain for 10 years. Then he had a moment of conversion, saw the error of his ways, wrote everybody's favorite hymn, Amazing Grace, and incidentally about 300 other hymns, many of which are still sung, and repented of his sins. Well, it didn't happen that way at all. He was a slave ship captain for 10 years, and incidentally, his diaries and logbooks are the most complete evidence we have of what life on a slave ship from a ship's officer's point of view was in that era, hundreds of pages. But then he left the trade not for reasons of conscience, but for medical reasons. He had a sort of epileptic-like seizure, didn't want it to happen on shipboard, so he left the sea. Then he went into the ministry, and incidentally, he'd had his conversion to evangelical Christianity before entering the slave trade, not afterwards. He used to hold services on shipboard for the crew while the slaves were chained up down below. After leaving the sea, he entered the ministry, wrote all these beautiful hymns, became the most famous evangelical preacher of his day. But he still had all his savings invested with his former employer, who still had a fleet of slave ships on the ocean. And he only really came out against slavery about more than 30 years after he left the sea. And he did so only because, quite suddenly, this enormous popular movement took life in Britain, and it was really no longer possible for him to keep quiet.
Adam, I just want to give our listeners some sense of the time period. Your book opens with, I think, about a dozen men meeting in a tavern in London, and then the slave trade ends. I don't remember what year that begins, and it ends, or the British finally ended at some point 30 or 40 years later. Just give us a sense of that.
Okay, here's the basic time scale, which is different, of course, than how it was for the United States. This movement in England, really in an organizational sense, began with this meeting you speak of a dozen men, actually in a Quaker bookstore and printing shop in London in 1787. It caught fire about 6 or 8 months later, and you can actually find the very moment that it caught fire, which I found fascinating to try to figure this out. There were no opinion polls, of course, in Britain at that time. But there were people whose job it was to gauge public opinion, who were the proprietors of London's debating societies, because if they had a popular topic, they could fill the hall, like a rock concert promoter today knows which bands are hot. Well, suddenly, after many, many years, when no debates in London, and these public debates were a big spectator sport, no debates, or virtually no debates, had been about slavery or the slave trade, abruptly, February 1788, half the debates in London are about slavery or the slave trade. It sort of caught the public imagination quite suddenly, became a huge popular movement. Then, to sort of compress the story, in 1807, the British Parliament voted to end the slave trade, not to end slavery itself, but to end the slave trade. And that was a very momentous
milestone because Britain controlled about half of the Atlantic slave trade at that point. So the superpower of the day saying we're going to stop was a big deal. It didn't end slavery. The end of slavery in the British Empire didn't come until the 1830s, when it was emancipation of the slaves was speeded up by a huge slave revolt in Jamaica, 1831-32, which the British Army suppressed, as they had all previous slave revolts, but this time with great difficulty. Simultaneously, the abolition movement in Britain revived in a big way, and finally, Parliament voted to free the slaves, and that took effect August 1st, 1838. 25 years before it happened in this country. And what makes the whole British movement so interesting to me is that, unlike the United States, slave revolts in the West Indies played a big role. So it became a widespread popular movement stretching across the class spectrum in Britain in a way that it never quite did in the U.S.
Adam, there's one other major figure in the movement that we wanted you to talk a bit about, and that's the former slave, Olaudah Equiano.
I actually have to admit I'd never heard of him until the book, although I guess you said it's a sign now in a lot of colleges. But
he's starting to be rediscovered, a very interesting man. He had been a slave in the British West Indies, and he had earned his freedom. That is, by he was a slave sailor on ships that sailed between various West Indian islands and the American South. And he would, on the side, buy things in one port and then sell it for more money in the next port, a sort of natural entrepreneur. He earned enough money to buy his freedom, that is, to buy himself from his owner. Then he made his way to Britain, where he spent most of the rest of his life. He was literate, knew how to read and write, and in 1789 he wrote his autobiography, which is a fascinating book. A very modern book, because up to this point in time, almost all the argument over slavery had been carried on in terms of biblical references and philosophical treatises and proving that the Bible said slavery was wrong and so on. And here, for the first time, is a former slave writing the story of his life and telling you what it was like at every stage. And the book became a bestseller. He was also a very, very shrewd book promoter. He felt publishers were going to cheat him, so he self-published. And then he went on a five-year book tour of England, Scotland, and Ireland, turned his book into a bestseller. It was also published in the U.S. and in several other countries, and I think was a very important face of this movement, because for thousands of people who heard him speak in Britain, he was the first former slave they'd ever seen, and it allowed them to sort of put a human face on what they were reading.
Adam, can you talk a bit about your view of reparations?
We did have on the show, Adam, someone whose book review you did in the New York Times, Marcus Rediker, who ends with a very, short, not really a detailed piece on his view about reparations. And so I'm just interested in your views, looking at Marcus's views as well as your own.
And we're speaking with Adam Hochschild, who's written the book Bury the Chains, about the emancipation movement in England in the 19th century. So, Adam, what's your position on reparations?
Well, people mean different things by reparations, but I'm somewhat uncomfortable with the concept, and especially with the word, for this reason. The way the word reparations is usually used, it implies that once you make a cash payment for something, the job is done. The apology is made, it's all over. In other words, something terrible was done to somebody or to their ancestors a long time ago or whatever, you pay them off, and that's taken care of. Whereas it seems to me, if we look at the tremendous human damage done by an institution like slavery, it's much more deeply rooted than that. It's not something that even the greatest of cash payments are going to take care of. It's something we can begin to tackle with social programs, affirmative action programs, and all sorts of other things, but it's going to take a long time. It's not a one payment and it's done kind of thing. And now I think a lot of people, I have a lot of friends who disagree with me on this and say, no, we have to push the concept of reparations. But they always have to say, well, we mean something different than that. Well, I think if mean something different than that, we better pick a better word to use, repairing the damage or something like that. There's a further reason why I think reparations is not necessarily a good political strategy, which is that it takes the focus off the ongoing injustices that go on in the world in the present day. Yes, Africa was horrendously damaged by, you know, millions of people being taken from it by the slave trade. But right now, we are putting Africa at a huge economic disadvantage by the way that globalization tilts the playing field in favor of the wealthy countries, the big multinationals, and so forth. The U.S. And Europe don't want to allow, you know, small farmers in Africa to compete fairly on the global economic stage. If we dropped agricultural tariffs and subsidies, that would do more, I think, to raise the economic situation in Africa than any kind of reparations that we could imagine.
Yeah, I think when I remember the interview we had with Marcus Rediker, and I know you reviewed his book, Slave Ship.
Yeah, a terrific book.
Right, a great book. And at his position, I'm sure you probably talked to him, but was that money wasn't really what this was about. He still uses the term reparations, but he said it's a much broader issue than that. And he said, let's talk to the people who really faced the consequences of 400 years of the Atlantic state slave trade. And over a period of time, let's see how they look at this issue rather than just saying it's a sum of money.
Well, I think that I would definitely agree with, but because the word reparations is so linked with the idea of a sum of money in people's mind, I think we need to find a different word, because I'm certainly for doing everything we can to repair the damage, the enormous human damage over the generations that an institution like slavery wrought. And I'm even more in favor of doing everything we can to rectify injustices that are being perpetrated by all sorts of institutions like the World Trade Organization and all kinds of other things we could name in the world right now. But I feel different words are better used to describe those ideas.
Adam, let me take you back to the anti-slave movement, because what was interesting to me reading it, really interesting, apart from the historical part, is how a group of people, 12 people, in a particular social moment, were actually able to change, you know, one of the key injustices in the world, possibly the key injustice in the world. And you talk about it as really the sort of precursor of all of our modern citizen movements for social change. And in some way, it's an optimistic message, even if only one of the 12, I think, survived to see it. It's an optimistic message for a lot of us looking at the world today. And can you address what kinds of techniques, what they used, and why you look at it as maybe in the same way that I mentioned, as an optimistic message?
Yeah, well, here's why I see it as something that inspires optimism in me. It certainly was not the first movement for social change. It certainly was not the first, you know, movement of oppressed people, but I think it was the first movement of a certain type, which is that all through history, oppressed and enslaved and colonized people of one sort or another have been staging rebellions, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But this was the first time that a large number of people in one country got outraged on somebody else's behalf, on behalf of people of a different color in another part of the world. That had never happened before, and that's what's so interesting and exciting to me about this movement, because I think unless we can find ways of awakening that degree of empathy, you know, there's no hope for us going forward, because you look at the problems we're facing in the world today, something like global warming, for example. It is going to impact all of us, but it's going to impact the poor countries immeasurably more. And those of us living in the better-off countries, you know, we need to find ways of awakening our fellow citizens' empathy over this issue and many other issues as well. And I'm fascinated, as former activist, as a journalist, as, you know, somebody who's been in and around a lot of political movements in my life, by the techniques that these people used. They used what were the new media of the day, which were things like a poster. Everybody has seen the famous slave ship poster, you know, the one that is the sort of from the top down diagram-like view of a slave ship that shows the slaves lined up and packed in almost like sardines. It's on the cover of half the books about slavery. It's in every TV documentary about the slave trade, widely reproduced. Well, that poster was done by a local anti-slavery committee in the port of Plymouth, a committee that had been set up by this traveling organizer, Thomas Clarkson. And as soon as the central committee of the anti-slavery movement in London saw it, they realized what an enormously powerful tool it was. They ran off 8,000 copies, put them up in pubs all over England, and this was the world's first widely reproduced political poster. They also came up with what I think was the first logo ever specifically designed for a political organization. It showed a kneeling slave in chains surrounded by the legend, "Am I not a man and a brother?"
That was so interesting to me in your book because you addressed the issue that I guess it was made by the famous Wedgwood China people, right?
That's right.
And you actually talk about the evolution of that image because it's still of a African-American kneeling at the foot of essentially a white person, and you say that it was still an important symbol, but it still had that part of it.
It's definitely very paternalistic. It shows a slave on his knees sort of begging for help. It doesn't show a slave, you know, rising up, staging an uprising, which, of course, millions of slaves did at one time or another. But it was still a powerful image that drew people in. And something else that was significant about it, I think, was that because it could be reproduced everywhere, coat buttons, hat pins, women's jewelry, it was an image that women could wear. And this was a time when women couldn't vote, couldn't take part in political life in any way. Suddenly, women had a way of publicly, on the street, showing their sympathy for a cause in the way that today we can walk around, you know, with a lapel button for a political cause, you know, a slash mark across Bush's face or whatever. This was the ancestor of the lapel button.
Adam, what other mechanisms did they pioneer for our movement?
Well, in 1792, there broke out quite spontaneously, spurred by a couple of pamphlets, the largest consumer boycott that the world had at that point yet seen. In fact, the word boycott didn't even exist yet, but quite suddenly, over the space of a few months, an estimated 300,000 to 400,000 people in Britain stopped eating slave-grown sugar from the West Indies. They were impatient and angry that Parliament had not yet passed a law banning the slave trade, which was seen as the first step towards ending slavery. They were angry about this, impatient, so they sort of took the job of political pressure into their own hands by saying, well, we're going to pressure the slave plantation owners by ceasing to consume their product, sugar. So people began either going off sugar entirely or else proudly buying sugar that came from India, where it was not grown by slaves, although it was grown by people who were working in pretty miserable conditions.
There's one more person who gets a lot of the credit for ending the slave trade and who's actually featured in the movie, whatever the name is, that follows to a small extent your book, Wilberforce. Can you talk about his role, what it was, how it compared to Clarkson's in your view?
Well, William Wilberforce was a member of Parliament who for more than 30 years was really the principal voice against the slave trade and slavery within Parliament. And he deserves credit for that. He was also, in a personal sense, a quite warm, kindly, generous man who was a marvelous mimic and had a good singing voice, would have been wonderful fun to have dinner with. But he has become the public hero of this movement as it gets remembered in British schoolbooks and the like for two reasons, I think. One is that he was an evangelical Christian, so the evangelicals love him and have ceaselessly promoted him for about 200 years. The other reason he makes a convenient national hero is that unlike Thomas Clarkson, who, as I was saying, was a great sympathizer of the French Revolution and many other radical causes at the time, Wilberforce, on every issue other than slavery, was an arch reactionary. He believed that women should have no place in politics, that the franchise should not be any broader than it was, that labor unions were the worst danger that Britain faced, that public bathing in the Thames should be forbidden because men and women might see each other swimming and all kinds of things like this, terribly reactionary on every conceivable issue. But on slavery, he was very good. Paradoxically, I don't think he could have had the influence he did in Parliament were he not a conservative on all these other issues, because otherwise his fellow MPs would have written him off and paid no attention to him.
Adam, how did you become interested in this topic, and what might we hope to read from you in the future if you've started a new one?
Well, I'm working now and have been for the last 3 years on a book about the First World War, which has been a long-time obsession of mine. And I'm particularly interested in the people on all sides who refused to fight, because if there was ever a war that was worth refusing to fight in, that was it. And that's what I'm working on now. I think I have another 2 years or so of work to do on it, so unfortunately you're going to have to wait a while before you can read that. As for the other part of your question, Heidi, about how I got interested in the British anti-slavery movement, I think it was because it just seemed a remarkable example of citizen activism to me, a pioneering one that, although we don't really aren't so aware of it, it set the models for all kinds of things that we take for granted today. And I talked about some of them, you know, consumer boycott, political posters, lapel buttons, even such a basic thing as having a group agitating for a cause with its headquarters in the nation's capital and chapters around the country in constant communication with it, something we take for granted today. This was almost unheard of at the time.
We're talking with Adam Hochschild, author of Bury the Chains, and he's author of another book that I want to see how you relate to it, many books, but another one that I loved called King Leopold's Ghost, about King Leopold's essentially private fiefdom in Africa, in the Congo. That also concerned at least people standing up, particularly a man named Morel, as I recall, for ending what was going on in the Congo, which I think you estimate 10 million people killed as a result of the attempts to get rubber, etc. And that book, of course, you wrote before you wrote Bury the Chains, but it also is about a human rights movement in a sense. Can you talk about with the movement and the actions that came out of Bury the Chains? Was that influential in how the Morel and others went about going after the Congo? Was there a relationship at all?
I think it was, because when I wrote King Leopold's Ghost, which came out 9 or 10 years ago, about how people, again, primarily in England, brought the world's attention to these enormous atrocities going on in Africa, I noticed that they always spoke of themselves as being in the grand tradition of the abolitionists. And I knew something about William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass in this country, but I didn't know much about England, so that made me interested. I also noticed that when they had the first meeting of what was called the Congo Reform Association in Liverpool in 1904, they had a great-grandson of William Wilberforce on the platform.
Oh, how wonderful.
And this was judged to be symbolically very important. But I love the sense that there is sort of a chain of continuity between these various human rights movements down through the ages. I actually just noticed something that quite touched and delighted me last week, which was that there was a very nice review of Bury the Chains that appeared in a scientific journal for climatologists.
Wonderful.
People concerned about global warming. And I thought, aha, they see the connection.
Well, you know, when I was walking down the street with someone who just finished Bury the Chains, they said, Micah, you have to read this book because as you and the center are trying to stop torture, stop indefinite detentions, this book will give you hope that this is possible. One other question, which is the question of the individual's role, not only in history, but obviously in stopping a particular evil. And you mentioned earlier Clarkson's trip to France. And of course, France was owned the richest colony in the Caribbean, possibly in the world, slave trade, Haiti, and went through a whole issue about whether to stop that trade. And Clarkson goes to France to try and see what he could do on that, and he fails. And you draw some lessons from that about the ability of really even groups like the 12 that started in England to actually change things in different social milieus. If you can just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I think that You know, obviously individuals can affect history. It's interesting that when we think about this, we usually think only in terms of political leaders and very often the bad guys, you know, Hitler, Stalin, Napoleon, how different things would have been without them. But I think that people who are outside the political structure, who are activists and organizers, can also affect history, and this is an example of it. But we also know that there are all kinds of social forces that make either fertile or barren ground for a social movement. And I think for various reasons, England at this time in the 1780s was very fertile ground for a social movement of this sort. It was a pregnant political moment midway between the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. Many people in England actually had been on the side of the rebel American colonists who wanted to break away. That war that Britain fought to try to prevent this country's independence had many people objecting to it in Britain. So there was a certain amount of dissension in the air. And people in England also, I think, were justifiably proud of the idea that they had rights which people in the rest of Europe didn't have. They had a completely free press, no censorship, a parliament that had much more power than the king. None of this existed anywhere else in Europe. And I think it made the leap of empathy that one had to take from feeling proud of having your own rights to feeling outraged that somebody else doesn't have those rights. It made that a leap that was easier to take there than in France, which had just overthrown a near absolute monarchy. There was no tradition of freedom of the press. A large part of the population was deep in rural misery. There wasn't that fertile ground for a movement.
Well, Adam, extraordinary interview, and I really appreciate it. And the books are, of course, I think speak for themselves, but they're just wonderful. And
good.
We look forward to your next book, although we
try to
going,
speed it up a bit.
We go back and read the ones we've missed. But
That's right. Yeah, you can.
Adam, thanks
again,
so
Adam.
Much.
Okay. Well, it was a real pleasure being with you.
Thanks
bye
a lot,
bye.
Adam. So long.
Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.